Hello and welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, your co-host of this conference. Today, I'm speaking with Jason Gaddis, author, relationship expert, and coach who teaches people the one class they didn't get in school, how to do relationships. Jason leads one of the most in-depth and comprehensive relationship educational programs and trains relationship coaches all over the world. He's the host of the Relationship School podcast with over 4 million downloads. And he's the visionary behind the Relationship School. His book, Getting to Zero, is out now. Jason Gaddis, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, great to be here.
So I want to start by asking you, what inspired you to start working with couples in the first place? Was it, you know, your background or your history, or why is this the kind of work you wanted to do?
Yeah, I didn't have a plan, actually. I just started trying to help people after I became a psychotherapist. And I was like, I work with everything and everybody because I wanted experience. And I was working at mental health centers and a wilderness therapy program, inpatient. And I was working with a variety of people, and I kept seeing, it seemed to me, I was drawing conclusions that everybody's issues, whether it was a mental health issue or something else, was a relationship issue. So I started to focus on relationships, and I started to focus on couples because it just sort of organically went that way. Mm. And also it was nice to have, I was doing, prior to this, I was doing a lot of men's work, and some men they're just reluctant, resistant. And when they come into couples work, there's an opportunity to break into the male who's maybe not seeing the value and win him over, so to speak, and like have him see that this is actually a really important thing and important work he could do. So I was also really, I started primarily focusing on couples many years ago because of that, trying to help the men.
I love that context. And obviously we don't want to overgeneralize. There's plenty of men that do go to therapy, but yeah. Speaking generally, that I have found that, and my therapist and I have a joke that she sees men who are there for like career counseling, right? Not therapy. And that she has to contextualize it correctly for them in order to get their engagement and participation. But, you know, if it doesn't impact like their income or their relationship status, sometimes men can seem disinterested in doing that work. And what do you think the main part of resistance is for that?
I mean, there's so much shame in the male psychology and persona, and that it's, you know, men are subordinating still to the construct around masculinity and what it means to be a man that they adhered to since childhood, really unconsciously, and they just haven't evaluated that. So they're up against a lot to sort of break through some of those invisible barriers there in themselves. But when they do, it's like pretty liberating, I think, for a lot of guys.
Absolutely. So I want to shift a little bit in talking about relationships, in asking about, in your experience, how common is it for couples to come to you with toxic relationship patterns and that they're unclear about how to disrupt them, that they just kind of see the same thing happening over and over again? Is that common for you?
Well, what do we define as toxic?
Yeah, I mean, maybe exactly my definition or yours, but it can go several different ways. But I mean, for me, toxic is when there's either an imbalance where like one partner is doing a bunch of the emotional heavy lifting and doing the emotional work, and the other one's kind of checked out and doesn't find value in it. It can be if somebody's having mental health struggles of their own, or they're ill, or they're just under a tremendous amount of stress. And so we're acting out in ways that don't increase relationship trust and safety. These are the kinds of dynamics I'm talking about.
Yeah, cool. That first example you shared, I'd say is pretty normal. And I wouldn't maybe call that toxic, but I could see how it can become that way over time. If I'm doing the work and you're not, kind of thing. And so I would add, toxic to me is like, there's a cortisol drip going on like all day long in the relationship. And I like the word you use, acting out. There's acting out by one or both people in the form of blame, not taking responsibility, not repairing conflicts consistently, all that creates an environment that's just really stressful and bad for both people over time. But if you grew up in a family that was like that, you think this is normal. And so you don't, you stay in these kind of relationships, which is mind-boggling to people who grew up in, you know, environments where there was healthy relationships. It's like, why can't you just leave? And it's like, it's not like that. It's not that easy. So your original question was why about toxic relationships?
Well, I was kind of trying to normalize for people that sometimes we get into these cycles of relating that aren't healthy, that don't increase safety, don't increase connection, don't increase trust. And that it's, you know, kind of common for us to get into these patterns. But I was really questioning that. Is it common for you to see people with these kind of patterns of disconnection?
Yes. I because I think I'm in the relationship space, I get people who come here for help, right? People who maybe are having a good experience don't come for help. So a lot of people are in really challenging relationships. And I don't know if COVID made it worse or if just we're all, you know, phones and the stress of tech and our overwhelming constant access 24/7 to everybody and the comparison. I wonder if our relationship lives are worse than ever in some ways, which is sad, but we definitely get a lot of folks here that coming to the relationship school really wanting to change something, which is great because we get someone saying, I'm in a toxic relationship or a bad relationship and I want it to be different. How do I do that? Which is my favorite kind of person.
Absolutely. And speaking of that cortisol drip that you were talking about earlier, I don't think I became as well aware of that dynamic until I had a child. And my child and I dispositionally are very opposite. And so it took a lot of work for me personally, because I'm not going to change him. He's a child. He's still developing, right? I can steer, but I'm not going to change him. So I had to like think about myself and our dynamic. And I would get so wrapped up in matching so if he was going to be combative, I was going to be combativer. And like, you know, we have these relationships where we're matching energy or we're in it. That's what it felt like. And it started, of course, during COVID lockdowns with homeschooling. I just realized that we were just in this pattern of like matching. And I suddenly had to be like, I'm the adult here. I'm the only one that has the actual wherewithal and executive functioning to change this dynamic. So what do I have to do within myself to like step back, reset, get regulated, lower my own cortisol, and then try to conduct myself like a parent?
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that honesty. Exactly. Yeah, I get into these things with my son, who's a teenager now, and we just I don't know if combative is the word, but it's close to that, where he just makes a comment and then I make a comment, and pretty soon I'm like, what? Wait, hold on a second. What? I'm the grown up here. What's going on?
Right. How did we get here? And it's matching energies, and we're speaking unconsciously. Like, it happens to a lot of us. And
yeah,
I think that's really what I want to talk about. And just and you mentioned repair earlier. So for people that aren't kind of familiar with the concept of repair, which I learned from Tina Payne Bryson, and just relationship repair, every relationship is going to have conflict, whether it's friends, parents, children, romantic. So when we conflict, because even somebody who's a relationship expert like yourself and me, who plays one on TV, when we have conflict, how do we then navigate it once we realize what's going on? How do we repair?
Yeah, I mean, that's the most important question, honestly. And I want to maybe house this inside of a conversation around insecure relationships versus secure ones, if we want to use kind of an attachment science lens like Tina would, that insecure relationships don't recover after conflict, almost never. And secure relationships recover, you could say, all the time after conflict and after challenges in life out there and between us in here in our home and in our relationship. Like the resiliency of both people to be able to recover and reconnect requires what I think is now a popular term called repair, which I just define as making it good again, like getting back to a good place. And that's what my whole book was about, is like, how do we get back to zero or back to a good place? And it's really just about being grownups, you know, being adults who listen until the other person feels understood, or we take responsibility for our part in the dynamic. We understand the impact on the other person so we can empathize. There's a lot of tools we can use to and employ to do our part to get back to a good place. And it's obviously, in a toxic relationship, usually one or more people is resistant or doesn't want to play by these kind of rules or agreements for whatever reason. And it's really a problem, because if you can't get back to a good place, you're going to be in inherently insecure relationships your whole life.
Yeah. And you said something earlier about shame, and we were talking about masculinity, but I've also found that just that resistance, regardless of who you're talking about, is steeped in shame, regardless of, you know, sex or gender. And so much of it is defensiveness. And that maybe if you could talk about where that comes from beyond shame, of just like the protective nature of defending yourself, yeah. Right? Like yeah. You can perceive in conflict that you are being attacked.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when I'm attacked, the human instinct is to defend, right? And self-protect. And I think it's so 101 in human behavior, but we forget that it sort of goes out the window in a partnership, and we do the thing, we blame and we attack and we criticize. And what do we expect? Like, we're going to expect a defensive response. But underneath that, if the person could soften, let's say, and that requires a tremendous amount of maturity to soften and go vulnerable below the defensiveness 5 minutes later, 5 hours later, or even during, to admit and acknowledge, like, wow, I feel really ashamed and bad about how I've behaved here. And I don't want you to see me in that. And I want to hide and run away. And if I push you away and make you wrong, then I don't have to go there into those vulnerable places and feel like terror. Because when I was a kid and I got vulnerable, I got humiliated or bullied or hit or whatever. So, you know, there's a lot of layers here. But it is sort of to be expected that people are going to defend when we blame.
And I love that context that you just gave us around kind of what all of the processes that are happening in the background. And I think sometimes, especially for extra sensitive or empathetic people, or people who kind of tend toward more codependency, or that we understand all of that to such a degree that we overcompensate, or we're more resilient than we necessarily should be in allowing someone else to take accountability for their actions, right? Like, we contextualize, like, oh, well, they had a tough childhood, or, oh, they, you know, this and that about them, or they've got a lot of pressure, or, you know, I know that they feel shame. So I'm not going to hold them accountable for what they do. And that in and of itself creates a level of toxicity in the relationship as well, right?
Yeah, completely enabling, right? I'm enabling the person to keep getting away with bad behavior, behavior that's hurtful, behavior that's damaging the relationship, behavior that's, you know, just impacts us both. And it's, you know, my wife and I talk about this all the time, because she primarily works with couples. Now I'm primarily teaching courses, but just how difficult it is to break the cycle of blame and help people understand that we're a team. Like, it just boggles our minds sometimes that people sign up, okay, hey, let's get married, let's be a team, and then let's not act like a team for like 2 decades. She's like, what? Who agrees to this? And I do think if people can grok and get the view that this is not how it should be, that people should be held accountable in a relationship, there's agreements that we can live by that protect us from hurting each other, hurting ourselves, hurting the relationship. Gosh, it would go so much better, but it's, you know, a lot of us are kind of dense here.
Well, and you know, we sign these imaginary contracts, or sometimes actual legal binding documents, in partnership or in relationship and families. And then I think sometimes we're like, well, that's done. It's kind of like a transaction of like, yeah. Oh, you know, and we forget we're on the same team, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We took vows. Hey, we took vows and we had this $25,000 wedding and you can't you just love me? Like, isn't love enough? And people use that excuse all the time. Like, well, we love you. We really love each other. We just struggle. I'm like, dude, love is never enough to make this work. Like, you got to do so much more than just love or be loved.
And I mean, I don't know about you, but I've changed a lot since I got married. I've grown,
yeah.
I've adapted, oh. I've moved across the country twice. Like, I'm not the same person I was when I made that agreement. So I need to make sure that I'm keeping my partner up to date with the ways in which I'm developing and also vice versa, make sure that I'm really in tune with how he's growing and changing too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's so many life stages we all go through, from moving to having a child to empty nesting, menopause, like work, getting fired, losing a job, getting a disease, getting an autoimmune disorder, getting cancer. I mean, it's just like, it's relentless in terms of what can happen to us and what we go through. And it really does take the growth kind of oriented people to see that and to acknowledge that's actually going on. And I change as a result, and therefore that might impact you. And so how are we going to deal with these changes? It's I just think a lot of people stop growing after college or sometime after high school. They just stop developing themselves. And then there's, of course, arrested development prior to that for at very young ages, depending on what the issue is. But, you know, to be successful in a relationship requires a tremendous amount of developmental work on oneself.
And it's not necessarily societally or culturally rewarded, right? Like if we go to school and we earn a bunch of degrees and we are really successful at work, we are rewarded in our success or finances or whatnot. But if we continue to develop psychologically and relationally in our love and in our lives and in our relationships with other people, it's not like there's big ribbons for that anywhere other than just life satisfaction, is there?
No, I think you're right. I mean, the big ribbon though is the sense of fulfillment and self-respect I have being a compassionate, caring human, you know, with another person. And then the terrible feelings we have when we act out of integrity. Like there's a nice feedback loop there, I think, that's like negative feedback loop means I'm probably being an asshole. Positive feedback loop means I'm probably being a good person.
Yeah, exactly. And I know in your book, if I remember right, you had something about like a relational blueprint. Can you remind me what that was and tell us about it?
Yeah. So the download there is we all come into this world, you know, there's nature and nurture, of course. So there's temperament and things that we can't sort of quote control. And then there's how we're raised. And that starts in utero with how the mother is doing and how the co-parent is treating the mother. And then we come out into the world and it's all about attachment and how well that bond goes between caregiver and child. And those first 2 years are critical, that if they go well, we have a relational blueprint that's going to basically say later in life, we're more likely to have successful relationships, particularly close relationships like a partnership, because that's when the attachment system turns on. Doesn't turn on in the same way in friendships. And when that doesn't go well, and there's sort of insecure attachment along with some kind of trauma or an overly engulfing mother or an overly punishing mother, distant father or whatever, then that's where we start setting up these personality disorders and also attachment challenges that people have that go really deep into our psychology and our nervous system. And then we can't figure out why later in life we struggle so much, but those first 2-3 years are pretty pivital.
Yeah.
To get a blueprint that is going to set us up for success.
Absolutely. And so what do you recommend when people come into you and they've got these patterns, and what's step one? Like, what are you telling them in their, you know, first 5 visits? Like, here's how we're going to relate to one another from this point forward. Here's how you're going to do the work inside yourself and then with one another.
Yeah. I mean, I try to keep it really simple, you know, like, hey, let's do one thing. You're going to get really good at repairing these conflicts that are unresolved. And it's harder with a couple that's gone 30 years without ever repairing a conflict. I mean, that's amazing. I've worked with couples that 30 years, they could never successfully resolve anything. So they just compound. And then there's just a tremendous amount of resentment. So that's almost like too hard to work through. Those people are, they'll come in, but they want to just get you to join with their position about how they're right and the other person's wrong. And it's like, no, you've played that game for 30 years. Like, where got you? So it's like repair. Like, can we, you know, if it's like every new married couple, it's like, look, you need to get good at one thing, and that's repairing after conflict. And then your life is going to be so much better. And the attitude of what I call standing for three will help you make a commitment to repairing after every single rupture or conflict. And standing for three just means I'm taking a stand for me and myself and my success and my values. I'm taking a stand for you, your success, your values, and I'm taking a stand for us. And then you do the same for me. And if we have that kind of orientation, like there's two boats, right, out in the ocean, and they're like a catamaran, and the bridge across the two boats that bridges the two together is the relationship. So we can be two individuals. We don't have to compromise or sacrifice who we are, because that's one of people's greatest fears in a relationship, is I can't be me here. Or I'm only going to get at what I want if I do conform to who you are and who you want me to be. So it's got to be two individuals, like really standing in themselves for themselves, but getting that there's an impact over there, and also standing for you to be yourself and who you want to become in your life. And then standing for us is the relationship, that we don't tolerate. Why would I be in a relationship if something is good for me, but it's not good for you? it's like, oh, like you have to become such a more mature person to be in adult relationships. And it's not all about you. I always tell people, never get married unless you're willing to learn how to collaborate and kind of give up some things in your life that's all about you and yourself. This is about sharing a life. So sharing space with someone. Yeah. So standing for three and repair are probably the two. I try to keep it so simple, right? And then it's like, how do we repair? Well, someone has to take responsibility and someone has to listen. And listen with a commitment to understand the other person until they feel understood. Those kind of things.
I'm so glad that you were explicit about it, because that was literally going to be my next question. Because sometimes people hear repair and they think it's just saying I'm sorry, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry without accountability and then follow-up action in the future is not actually any sort of an apology or repair. But repair differentiates from an apology, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, thanks. I mean, you're right. Too many people kind of, it's the get out of jail free card. It's like, hey, what I said, I'm sorry. Like, you should be not emotional anymore. You shouldn't be upset with me anymore. And most of our, I say most, I don't know if it's most, but many people's nervous systems don't let down with a simple apology, especially if the apology is coming from, I want to get out of this uncomfortable mess, like immediately. So I'm going to apologize because I'm so uncomfortable. It's like, that's not going to work to settle the other person's nervous system. We need, you know, ownership, empathy, and validation are three of the biggest things that we can do that will help the other person go, ah. And then if we want to add the kind of cherry on top, we can say, and I'm so sorry that I hurt you like that. Then an apology can be effective.
I love that context, the ownership, empathy, and validation. All those things. Yeah, I just had this, you know, I was imagining a situation. One partner comes home later than they said they were going to. The other partner's upset. And so they're just like, I'm sorry, because they can't stand the feeling that they've made the partner upset, right? It's like classic case. I'm apologizing not because I'm actually sorry or I understood how I impacted you, but because I don't like being uncomfortable with your discomfort.
Yeah, exactly. Which is just, you know, psychology nerd here terms is like differentiation, right? They're not differentiated so that the person can't have a separate experience. I can be okay knowing that you're really upset with me. I can be okay. It's uncomfortable and I don't like what I'm feeling given you're seeing you in pain, but it's not going to take me out and I'm not going to react and respond from this place.
Absolutely. And what did you call it earlier? The rule of three?
Standing for three.
Thank you. Yeah. I can see how those two things go together. It's you, it's me, it's us. And I'm going to take ownership, empathy, validation into it. Yeah. Yeah. I just, I can think of the possibilities are endless when you're operating from those two points of view.
Totally. But the big challenge, and probably why you're doing this conference, right, is we're with someone who won't do any of that. And then what?
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say,
always ask,
and then what, Jason?
My partner doesn't do this. Like what? Like it would be great if they would. And so then they, what typically happens is people spend an enormous amount of time trying to get the other person to do these things instead of just accepting who they're with and moving on. Because the thought of moving on is because of financial dependence or all the complications associated with being in a long-term marriage, say, with someone. I get it. It's very, can get very complicated to, quote, just leave, because it's never that easy. And people have to keep recognizing, I always tell people, start using choose language, you know, I choose to stay in this relationship where I'm not getting my needs met. And just say that out loud every single day and see how that feels. I choose to try to change my partner, which is trying to change the outside in order to get what I want over here. And just say that out loud a bunch. And like people need to see the inherent limitations of their approach before they go, oh, fuck, this is not a good use of my time. And this is like, it's pain either way. Pain staying in the relationship, pain leaving the relationship. Which pain do you want? But a lot of people want to stay in the pain of being in a really unhealthy, hurtful relationship where they don't get their needs met. And I can't, you know, cool. If you want that.
Yeah. It's like the discomfort, you know, over the discomfort you don't know yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's so many thoughts I have about just power dynamics. You know, when you make yourself the victim and you make somebody else the villain, giving away your power and not having your own agency over your life, because you know, there's a part of you that's uncomfortable with that kind of self-accountability and empowerment.
Yeah. And it means, you know, for a lot of people, they're going to have to face like why the victim in us, in each of us, won't get empowered is because it's terrifying. And it's like, I'm going to have to confront a lot of things about myself that I don't want to look at, see, feel, do, be with. So I won't self-activate and I'll continue to set up my life. So it's someone else's fault. I can't, I won't. And every, you know, all of us, I always like to say when we're talking about the victim, that all of us are victims when we get hurt. There's really like three different kinds of victims. There's the victim that gets hurt and blames the other person and has the outcome or the strategy to get better over there forever. And they'll kind of basically never get out of victimhood. There's the victim that recognizes, I might have a part here and I got hurt and it's appropriate that I'm a victim. And gosh, how do I move forward? Right. And I can't remember what the third one was, maybe it's just two, but the obviously all of us, when we get hurt, we don't want to stay hurt, stay angry, stay stuck. At least intellectually, we maybe don't. But we have to realize there's a journey to make to get unstuck, and not everybody's up for that, and that's okay.
Absolutely. And we never know how long anybody else's stage of stuckness is going to, our own or anybody else's, right? And that's what you were talking about earlier, about how long are you going to wait for your partner to change or beg your partner to change, or, you know, if you've taken your own accountability, it's, you don't get to predict when they get the inspiration to show up in the way that you've been begging them to.
Yeah. I mean, I was working with this guy and he was married for 16 years in essentially with a woman who was, you know, had all the features of borderline personality disorder. And he was a classic codependent, right? Trying to fix her, change her, trying to make the relationship work, getting stonewalled at every corner, and she just wouldn't own anything. Well, finally, long story short, is he, through our work together, he gets the courage to leave the relationship, right? Which is what he was scared to do, because that was the unknown that you were just talking about. Like, well, I don't know how bad that's going to get. And it got really fucking bad after he left. It's not like there was a celebration and like liberation, and now I get to experience this quote easy life and everything's kind of straightforward. It's like, no, the divorce was hard. The custody was hard. You know, he lost a tremendous amount of money. He had to sell his house. Like, it just got hard for like 2 fucking years. It was like brutal for him. So I get why people are like, I don't want to deal with that. It was sort of easier in some ways for him to stay in it and be miserable than to like self-activate and then have to face just a heroic journey of all the challenges, you know, and he's finally on the other side of it, but whoo, it's hard.
Yeah. I call it a hero's journey for a reason. Right.
That's right.
But I did want to touch on that is the, what you see from people when they do take action, when they do self-activate, even though it takes a while, that the reward of that at the end, it isn't, you know, the blue ribbon like we were talking about, but there is a different kind of reward, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. And a person, there's like this guy, the confidence, you know, and the belief in himself now compared to 2 years ago is way stronger. And his community support came in stronger. So his friendships are closer. He's more self-aware. He got to know all kinds of aspects of himself. He got back into therapy and started doing different work on you know, his trauma from the past and his family of origin stuff. So he's becoming who he's here to be because he had the courage to say no. And again, it's not easy, but I would, if I asked him now, I think he'd say, absolutely, I prefer this kind of pain than the pain I was in before. Because the pain I was in before, I was like leaving myself behind every single day. Now I have myself.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. And back to the point we were talking about at the beginning, that kind of cortisol ride all day long. And I think people really overlook and underestimate the amount of energy required to sustain in these relationships, and that once that's freed up and some healing's been done, the energy of what you attract, because you've done all of that work, whether it's friendships and, you know, your work relationships and the support that shows up once you prove to the world that you're ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You said it. I mean, the allostatic load, you know, the stress on the body over time is invisible, as Gabor Mate says. And so it's hard to know the consequences of that until you've, you know, your 40s and 50s, it's harder to kind of stuff that. It starts to come out in usually an autoimmune disorder of some kind and other health problems that are hard to diagnose and pin down. But it's intense, man, when people just stay drinking that water all day. It's hard on the body, the heart and mind.
Absolutely, not to be understated. Jason, thank you for your time today. How can people find out more about you and your work and your book?
Yeah, two places probably, jasongaddis.com, that's J-A-Y-S-O-N, Gaddis, G-A-D-D-I-S.com, or therelationshipschool.com. It's actually relationshipschool.com, no the, and we're on the social channels as well.
And you've got a podcast as well, right? Or did I just...
Yeah, we've got a great podcast, 400 and something episodes now, and going strong.
Fantastic. Jason, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was fun hanging.